Local schools named after figures from the Confederacy could soon see their names changed. A host committee is named as there are still security questions about the RNC coming to town. And COVID cases are spiking in Florida once again. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the week's top stories with our Friday roundtable. Another busy week and you can join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, the Mosh reopens with a new exhibit and with some social distancing. We'll tell you about it. But first this hour, time to discuss yet another busy week in the news as we welcome David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. Hi, David. Oh, I guess we'll have David in a minute. Journalist and author Nakeisha Williams is with us. Nakeisha, good morning.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, everyone.
And Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal. Hey, Tim.
How are you today?
Good to have you all on the show and lots to discuss this week. There's a new host committee named, but also security questions about the Republican National Convention coming to Jacksonville in August. Yeah. We'll also talk about Juneteenth, which is today, and spiking cases of coronavirus in this area. But we're going to begin with the news that the Duval County School Board has voted to start the process of changing the names of several local schools with ties to the old Confederacy. Now, the list of schools whose names could change are these: Joseph Finnegan Elementary, Stonewall Jackson Elementary, Jefferson Davis Middle School, Kirby Smith Middle School, Jeb Stuart Middle School, and Robert E. Lee High School. Now, in addition to this move by the school board, City Councilman Garrett Dennis has also introduced a bill to change the name of downtown Hemming Park, which also has ties to the Confederacy. He'd like to see it renamed in honor of Jacksonville's own African-American luminary, James Weldon Johnson. So we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at this in the context of the Black Lives Matter protests and efforts around the country to bring down statues and markers and names tied to the Confederacy. Let us know your thoughts about this. It's 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And I do believe we have David Bauerlein with us now. David, are you there?
I hope so. Can
okay.
y'all hear me now?
Yeah, we're doing all of this remotely, of course, in the context of coronavirus. So I appreciate everyone's continuing patience. Nakeisha Williams, let's begin with you. We saw the Confederate statue in Hemming Park come down and the other city markers to the Confederacy are also going to be removed, according to Mayor Lenny Curry. Now the school board is weighing in and they're changing the names of these schools, or at least starting the process. You know, a few years ago, after many years of activism, they changed the name of Nathan Bedford Forrest High School to Westside High. Forrest was named after the founding member of the Ku Klux Klan. So for activists who have long sought these changes, these moves are long overdue.
These moves are long overdue, and I applaud them. It's a shame that it has taken such a long time for this to happen, that it literally took another brutal death of a Black man by a police officer, where you see him begging for his life until he dies for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, for city leaders to recognize that, you know, white supremacy is real, that these monuments and markers and school names are just subtle intimidation tactics and microaggression to remind Black people that we were once enslaved and once in bondage. And so I think it's a beginning of a great conversation, but I'm also just watching it with optimism, but also just waiting for the other shoe to drop, because the day after the Hemming Park statue came down, of course, it was announced that the RNC was coming to Jacksonville, which, with the current commander-in-chief, whatever your feelings about him, he has not been a friend to racial justice.
There's so much happening in Jacksonville this summer. Mike Mendenhall, you've been reporting on the RNC news. We'll get into that in a moment. At the same time, there's a move by one city councilman to rename Hemming Park. And so the pace of change in this city around these issues is really quite something to behold for longtime observers who've seen very little movement for many years around these types of evolutions, you know?
Yeah, Melissa. And shortly after Councilmember Dennis announced that he was going to file that bill to rename Hemming Park, four more council members introduced a bill this week to rename Confederate Park at Hubbard Street to Springfield Park. So it's pretty clear that at least on a symbolic note, that the message that's being portrayed or that's being given by these protesters is you know being heard by the city council. And I think it's going to remain to be seen exactly what kind of concrete policies come out of city council to address racial inequities in Jacksonville and how aggressive those policies will be, and particularly when it comes to economic issues.
Right. David Bauerlein, changing the names of parks and schools is important, although it is symbolic in the end. Where policy goes is what we need to watch, right?
Exactly. So my understanding is a lot of these proposed name changes, they're going to go through this new committee that the council president, Tommy Azuri, set up, a social justice and investment committee. So they're going to be looking at some of these things that are symbolic but significant, debating those, and they're also going to be looking at more substantive type policy things in terms of actual investments in communities that have been left behind, in terms of different policies that might take on disparities, racial disparities that have been longstanding in the city, in a lot of different areas of the city. So it's all going to be a mix. There's going to be these symbolic actions, which perhaps are easier to grasp in some sense, and then some of the more long-term sustained efforts, if they actually happen, that are really going to be moving the needle more so than as far as actual changes on the ground.
That's right. Tim Gibbons, there are massive problems in this city with lack of good transportation, access to opportunity, poor infrastructure. There's a host of issues you could look at where the city, not only is the city facing pressure to reallocate some of its resources away from JSO, but also they're being pressured to reallocate resources in a time when they don't have a lot of money to spare.
Right. That is the challenge. It's it will be very easy for the city to basically kind of go, well, we'd love to do it, but you look at what the budget is like now. And I think that's one reason why people are trying to keep the pressure on is to make sure that doesn't happen. You know, as everyone has said, the idea of changing the name of a park is an important step. But really, I think that the infrastructure part of that committee's mandate, the investment part of their mandate, those are the things that are going to really make a difference. And you know, this is an issue that goes back to consolidation in Jacksonville, where you have parts of the city that were brought into Jacksonville and then basically just abandoned in terms of public investment. And like with the parks, this is an issue that people have been trying to work on, trying to push for years. So it's not like it just came up overnight, but now it looks like maybe something could be done.
Let's go to your calls. It's our Friday roundtable, 549-2937. What do you think of moves to change the names of local schools, parks, and other monuments and markers of the Confederacy here in Jacksonville? It's our first topic of the week. We'll get into some other news in a few minutes. 549-2937. Give us a call. Keith is in Riverside. Hi, Keith. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. It's a matter of record that Robert E. Lee himself was against erecting monuments to the Confederacy and to the Lost Cause. I spoke at the city council meeting regarding the renaming of Nathan Bedford Forest, and on one side you had people expressing anguish and pain, and on the other side you had people expressing revisionist history and defiance. City council would be wise to go back and look at that and understand exactly why this needs to be done, because the man for whom many schools are named after did not want that to happen. I think we should follow his lead.
All right, Keith, thanks for that. Nikisha Williams, it is a fact that the statues that went up in this city and many others went up after Reconstruction at the onset of the Jim Crow era in a reactionary move against what Reconstruction attempted to do in the South. And they were put up as part of a false narrative, the Lost Cause that Keith, that caller, referred to. The naming of the schools in Jacksonville was driven by the same sentiment. And as Keith pointed out, there will certainly be complaints about this. People that went to Lee High School or some of these other schools and that have, you know, vehemently objected to changing the names of these schools.
Can we just start with the South lost? Let's start there. The South lost the Civil War. Whether you say it was about slavery, whether you say it was about bringing the Union back together, the South lost. Slavery is over. Why are we celebrating a time in our history where we had disunion over keeping people, actual people, in bondage? Why are we celebrating that? This was not a war of Northern aggression, as some people like to say it is. And even if you say that the Confederacy is part of our history or our heritage, acknowledge it in the context that it existed. It existed to keep Black people enslaved, to promote the economic activity of the South and its crops. Let's just start there. There is nothing to celebrate about that. I didn't go to a school in the South, and the school I went to in Chicago was not named after a Confederate general, but imagine how students feel when Black and Brown students feel when they are in those classes at this school and they are learning about the Civil War. What are they learning? They're not learning the true context of the school that they're in, the people whose names their schools bear, their mascots, and all of this. It's not right. You're continuing to oppress and to uphold systemic racism and white supremacy by continuing to have these microaggressions that are embedded in the bedrock of our American history and are then internalized by Black people and white people for the duration of their lives. It has to stop, and it has to start somewhere.
Thanks, Nikisha. And that's absolutely right. This country never forced the kind of reckoning that you saw at the end of World War II in the former Nazi Germany with the Nuremberg trials, that you saw at the end of apartheid in South Africa with its Truth and Reconciliation Commission. In the interest of binding up the wounds of the nation, it was said at the time, in the aftermath of the Civil War, the South was allowed to tell itself a false narrative, essentially, about the leading figures of the Confederacy and why the war was fought. And, you know, this reckoning is 150 plus years overdue. We are living through it right now here in Jacksonville. And, you know, David, this is something that I think you're seeing belatedly, public officials following the lead of the public who have weighed in so loudly on this. The protests that we saw in Jacksonville over the last several weeks are some of the largest that this city has ever seen. And, you know, the whole thing about the schools, let me ask you about this, too. Kids don't learn in Duval County Public Schools the true history of this community. They don't know about Axe Handle Saturday. They're not typically taught a lot about James Weldon Johnson and A. Philip Randolph, who hailed from Jacksonville and were towering national figures in the civil rights movement. And so in addition to the name changes of the schools, some school board members have said they need to look at changing the curriculum, the local curriculum, too.
I think that would be a good idea. I mean, I think people certainly should know more about their history in general of Jacksonville, and that should be something that's taught more in schools. I know my two children went through public schools and got great educations, but I don't really think they learned much about Jacksonville during that time. And certainly, when you're teaching the civil rights movement, Jacksonville was part of that. It had A. Philip Randolph, who came out of Jacksonville, was a towering figure in the civil rights movement. James Weldon Johnson, who, by the way, is who Garrett Dennis would like to rename Hemming Park after, wrote the Lift Every Voice and Sing, and was a big figure here in Jacksonville during a time when African Americans were very prosperous in this city, and it was a place where a lot of Black people moved in order to make their fortune. So I think you're exactly right, Melissa. There's a lot more that can be taught, and for that matter, there's a lot more that can be taught to all of us about what's going on, about some of these events. Axe Handle Saturday is going to get a lot of attention on the 50th anniversary observance in August, partly because it's going to be taking place at the same time as the Republican National Convention. And there's going to be a lot of media in town that are going to be covering that. So it's going to be widely known. And if people don't know about it now, they're going to know about it by the end of August.
We'll talk about the RNC in just a moment. But first, let's go to Les on the West Side. Go ahead, Les.
Good morning. This certainly seems to be a disputable controversy. But I just wanted to find out if any of your guests knew how Germany has handled this kind of a controversy.
Well, not only did they hold the Nuremberg trials at the end of World War II, but the Nazi flag is banned in Germany. And you can't fly it anywhere. About. And kids in Germany are taught beginning in kindergarten all about the atrocities of the Nazi era. They're not taught a revisionist history about it either.
So it's been completely erased from the public view.
I don't think it's been erased so much as that they understand that the Nazis committed atrocities against their fellow citizens, and they've made enormous efforts to make sure that younger generations know about the Holocaust and that they don't fall prey to anti-Semitism today. And I think that's the difference. Thanks, Les. And
having lived in Germany for a while, just to help the caller, it's not been erased. German school children go to concentration camps to witness the horror that the country did. The history is still there. The difference is they don't have these statues there. You know, it's not a statue to Hitler. It's a memorial and a commemoration. And that's why I think people draw a very big distinction between remembering the history, because history is important, even the bad parts of history. We talk about Axe Handle Saturday. That's part of history. The Civil War is part of history, but there's a difference between remembering it and learning from it and commemorating it and celebrating it.
Thanks for that. It's 549-2937 as we talk about the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. And let's talk about the RNC. A new host committee has been named. And there are security questions about the big event coming to town. Let's get into this. The security perimeter for the upcoming Republican National Convention, as business owners in the urban core want to know how this will be handled, with thousands expected to flood into downtown in late August for this three-day event when the president accepts his party's nomination for re-election here at ViStar Arena. Now, at the same time, the host committee for the RNC has been announced. It includes Mayor Curry, Republican representatives in Congress from our area, Visit Jack CEO Michael Corrigan, and more. Mike Mendenhall, you've been reporting on the Downtown Investment Authority and how they're fielding concerns from the so-called security zone for the RNC. What do we know about this?
So at the end of the at the Downtown Investment Authority meeting this week, one of the board members, Braxton Gillum, had raised a point that he had been contacted by several or by at least two business owners in downtown saying that the security zone for the event would go all the way to Hogan Street, which would actually encapsulate the Bank of America Tower as well as the Wells Fargo Center. A lot of these business owners are concerned about that. Well, immediately about access. They want to make sure that they can get to their offices and places of business, so their business isn't disturbed. But the fact that there hasn't been a lot of communication yet as to how this security zone is going to work, how it's going to disrupt or affect their week or their daily lives for these days of the convention. And Lori Boyer even said that she'd reached out to the administration. She told me she reached out to the chief administrative officer Brian Hughes's office, and she hasn't yet received clarity. And she said that she thinks that there's going to be more clarity as the event moves forward. But also, too, business owners have been kind of reluctant to go on the record, but they've been saying privately that their biggest concerns about the RNC coming in are the COVID-19 pandemic and whether it'll affect the spread, as well as protests, because I mean, there's expected to be a lot of protesters coming in from outside of the country or outside of the state, as well as residents of Florida and Jacksonville. And there's some questions on if the JSO and the security are going to be able to handle that kind of protest.
And Nikisha, as you pointed out, we learned the city was getting the RNC one day after the downtown Confederate soldier statue in Hemming Park was removed under cover of night. And so there have been whipsawing announcements in this city lately.
I thought that was ironic. It's like, you know, you do one thing to placate the Black people when you really have an entire agenda. Mayor Curry said that morning after the announcement was made that he had just found out that Jacksonville was going to be the whole city. I don't believe that. Even if Jacksonville didn't necessarily campaign to be the city, the fact that RNC committee members had been to Jacksonville weeks prior to visit to scout it out, I think it was very involved in making sure that the RNC came here. I get it. It's been a pandemic. The city's budget has taken a hit. Taxes are not coming in, tax dollars and things like that. I get it. It's a nice way to make a piece of change and bring people into the city. But there are better ways to make money, and there are better ways to show that you promote social justice and racial equality, but besides doing these symbolic acts of removing statues and considering whether or not you're going to change school names and things like that, when the real agenda will be here in August on the 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday to once again promote the commander in chief, who, no matter your feelings about him, we can all agree has not been a friend to racial justice.
The convention is falling on the anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday here in Jacksonville, which was a notorious incident where young folks trying to integrate downtown lunch counters were beaten by a white mob carrying baseball bats and axe handles in 1960. And, you know, Tim Gibbons, as others here have pointed out, there are still questions about the security for the event and also how it will be funded. Host committee, we've learned who's on the host committee, some bold-faced local and statewide names. They will have to raise quite a bit of money in a short amount of time. And Charlotte, North Carolina, is, I don't believe, going to send us the $50 million security grant that they were initially awarded to host the event.
There's still some debates about the federal money, but the head of the host committee in Charlotte told our sister paper there, point blank, none of our money is going to Jacksonville. The host committee there raised $50 million out of a $75 million budget. Clearly, there is a push to raise money in Jacksonville. I mean, stadiums don't pay for themselves. Security doesn't pay for itself. The host committee, that will be a big push. There's also already plans. Bloomberg was reporting yesterday, big events for high dollar donors happening on Amelia Island. So the push to get money is ramping up. I think the big question is going to be that issue of how much money will they get and what will the fallout be? I mean, obviously filling hotel rooms does have a benefit, but a lot of people are concerned about the economic benefit not being quite as high as it's been portrayed.
We will see a lot of people staying in high-dollar hotels in Nassau County, David Bauerlein. There will be heavy security costs. At the same time, downtown businesses and hotels have welcomed this event. We don't know yet how large the protests around Vistar Arena will be either. There will be a lot to watch leading up to this.
Well, absolutely. And going back, some of the questions about the security zone, the way I understand it and done in other cities is there's a real hard shell of security around the arena. That's where you have the barricades and Secret Service and all that kind of stuff. And then it'll be a larger kind of soft security zone or event zone. And that's what could stretch further into downtown. And within that event zone, that's where you'll have restrictions on protests and maybe designated areas where people can protest and designated parade routes. So there's a lot that still has to be done in terms of that. And then, you know, usually, you know, the federal government gives you $50 million to cover all the costs. Well, now you have $50 million that somehow has to be split between two cities because Charlotte's still doing some convention hosting and organizing, and they've already spent some money towards some of those. So nobody knows how much of that $50 million is going to come to Jacksonville. There's just a whole lot of questions which have yet to be answered since that announcement last week, and there's just 2 months till the convention.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Miller in Ponte Vedra. Hi, Miller.
Yeah. Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes. What I wanted to raise is, do we know the views of the descendants of these Confederate leaders? Their descendants, their kids, maybe their grandkids, are they remorseful of that era? And, what are their views now?
I guess it depends on who you talk to, Miller. Here's a tweet, though, from a listener just now coming into the show. He tweets, the Sons of the Confederacy are having a reunion in St. John's County next month. The headquarters is the hotel at World Golf Village. So, Nikisha, that shows you that there's still a very active contingent in this area and in parts around the country dedicated to preserving positive memories of the Confederacy.
I don't even know where to begin with this. I understand people want to preserve whatever their history was, your family history, it's been passed down. But let's not forget that out of the Confederacy, after Reconstruction was halted and you had the Hayes bargain, what was it, the 1876 election, became 100-plus years of basically domestic terrorism against Black people in the South with lynchings, which were communal gatherings where there were plenty of pictures taken and passed down as a type of, thing to celebrate watching a Black person hang from a tree. And that's only extended through the end of the 19th century, into the 20th century, and into the 21st century, where no matter the amount of progress Black people have made, in spite of all of the oppression and everything set up against them, we're still seeing the same things. Why you want to hang on to that heritage that celebrates the beginning of that and its most nascent beginnings is bonkers to me. I don't get it. But again, I'm not supposed to get it. I'm not going to ever celebrate a tradition or a heritage or any type of family thing that celebrated the enslavement of my ancestry and my ancestors. I'm never going to celebrate that. I'm never going to understand it. And for all the talk about allyship with all of the protests and the unrest that's happening now, allyship has to begin when people who don't look like me, who are white, call out the sons of the Confederacy and the daughters of the Confederacy and those who still uphold those ideals and beliefs, saying, this is wrong and it should stop, because we can never, as Black people, continue to move forward and to expand and to grow and to reach the full potential and realize what it says in the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. We can never get there if we don't have allies who are willing and ready to dismantle the system that our oppression was maintained under. It's just not going to happen.
I appreciate you saying that. And, on this program, we make an effort, as we always do on public media, to give a fair airing of lots of different opinions. But that said, you are absolutely right that the Confederacy was treasonous, and that it sought its whole motivation for seceding and going to war was first and foremost around the enslavement of African Americans, preserving that evil institution. And we've talked about that quite a bit on this show. We'll continue to do that, and I welcome your calls. Let's go to Anna. Go ahead, Anna. Hi, Anna. You're on the air. Go ahead, Anna. Okay, Anna, I think you might not be able to hear us. Stanley in Orange Park. Hello, Stanley.
Hey, Melissa, this is Stanley. Longtime listener. Every morning I listen to you.
Thank you.
Just wanted to give some input. I'm an African-American male, and so I grew up in the South, and I know that whatever they might think about their heritage and all that, I just say if you take the statues down and put them in a museum where people have to pay to see them, I don't see where that could be a problem. We've got a Confederate museum, I think it's up in Avondale somewhere, or in Ortega. So you can go see them there if you want to see them, or if it offends you so much that they're being taken down. But put it in a museum or a place where people have to subscribe to that idea and go look at them and take pictures or whatever. But just put them in a museum.
Stanley, thank you for that. Mike Mendenhall, the mayor has made moves or made an indication in that direction. Is that right?
Yeah. And we, you know, one of the things that he, even though he outlined or, you know, said that he's going to be taking down the statues, that he's going to order the removal of the Confederate markers, there still really isn't a known timeline, like how quickly it's going to happen. And, you know, and kind of going back to an earlier point in the show, I think there was some distaste with quite a few of the protesters, just within days of removing the statue in Hemming Park, that it was announced that the RNC was coming here. So I mean, there's still a long way to go before people feel like there's a concerted effort to actually make change within the city government here.
Madeline tweets the show. She shared a tweet with us from a descendant of Robert E. Lee. The Reverend Robert Lee tweeted the other day, "I will not sleep well until all of these Confederate monuments come down. Help me sleep better." And so that answers the question one caller had. David Bauerlein, you know, we're continuing to see local groups like the Northside Coalition of Jacks, the Jacksonville Community Action Committee, push for change. At the same time, a local judge, he denied release without bail to almost all of the protesters who appeared before him on June 1st. So that's something else that has been happening in Jacksonville that your paper, the Times Union, reported on.
Yeah, my colleague Andrew Pantazzi had a really good story where he kind of got a transcript of the hearings for these roughly 50 people. And you kind of put yourself in their shoes. They came downtown to join in the protests. They were arrested on charges like unlawful assembly or resisting arrest without violence. Eventually, almost all of those charges were dropped by the state attorney's office. But in between that, they were brought before the judge for their bail hearings. And Andrew's reporting is that they were given this offer pretty much in assembly line fashion, is how he put it, to accept a guilty plea. I think it was 5 days in jail. And, and most of them rejected that. And then a lot of them saw increases in bail in terms of being able to get out of jail at that point. So it was a case where the judge, rather than the prosecutors, were asking people to accept this, in a sense, punishment. And there's been a lot of questions, obviously, about how that was done. And, obviously, here you have the prosecutors, and when they actually did look at the cases in detail, dismissed them. So kind of maybe it's the shape of things to come about how things would be handled if there are future protests.
Larger criticisms of the cash bail system too. Tim Gibbons.
Yeah, I mean that's been an ongoing thing, and I think that's something that, and people probably are aware of this, but just this idea that the vast majority of things that are being protested about and worked on, from the city council committees to the taking down the monuments to complaints about the bail system, are not things that just sprung up. Across the nation, there's issues with, or people have issues with, how bail works, particularly for lower income people, and the idea of, is it the type of justice system that gets us to having actual justice? This seems like a particularly pernicious case with the charges ending up being dropped anyhow, creates it makes it an even more complex sort of situation.
And it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week with Nikisha Williams, David Bauerlein, Mike Mendenhall, and Tim Gibbons, and your calls. I'm going to take one more call on this. Then we're going to move on and talk about how COVID is spiking around the area once again.
Hey.
I know. What we don't want to know or hear about, but we have to tell you about. Let's go to Earl. Earl Johnson Jr. Of takeitdown.org is calling into the show. Earl Johnson Jr., good morning.
Morning, Melissa. Good morning. You know, what's happened with regard to the bail system throughout our country, especially in Jacksonville, and I'm no longer practicing law, but in my 26 years as a criminal defense lawyer, I can tell you that the number one criterion to become a judge, not only in Jacksonville, but all over the country, is to have a special relationship with the police, with police fraternities. And so when you go to a police fraternity event, it is scattered with judges and those lawyers who hope to become judges. What's not required is a relationship with the black community. That is why Jacksonville has never elected a black judge in its 200-plus year history. So we have a long way to go. What we're looking at with regard to racial inequity goes all the way back to Alexander Stevens' cornerstone speech. He was the vice president of the Confederacy, who made it clear that the Confederacy was rejecting the American notion that all men are created equal, specifically saying that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that the Negro's natural state is in enslavement by white people. And the treasonous South created for the first time, according to Alexander Stevens, the first government founded upon white supremacy. The second was Adolf Hitler's Third Reich. He was a big fan of the Confederacy and its archetype of a white supremacy government. The idea that these monuments are throughout a swath of our country in Alaska, Hawaii, Northern American Union states, and it's hard, and you're hard-pressed to find any Union monuments, memorials, makes you wonder who actually won the war.
Yeah, I mean, the old saying is the North won the war, but the South won the narrative. And now 150 years later, we're seeing a huge effort to finally recast that narrative and tell the true story.
And it's echoed throughout. So we don't learn it in school. I remember in 1983 challenging a young white professor who gave the old narrative that blacks liked being slaves and we were virtually lost without our white masters. I challenged him to just explain to the class what the whipping boy was. And so the experience of Africans in America has always been a lack of protection by the law, has always been violence against us by white people, and always from the time of birth where you see white women are 5 times less likely to die during maternity than their black counterparts, where through school from kindergarten, 12th grade, black children are more harshly disciplined than their white counterparts for the same conduct. That happens in the workplace. That happens in the boardroom, in the classroom, in the courtroom. And so given all of that, it is finally time to rip off the Band-Aid. You know, Johnson & Johnson Band-Aid, 100-year-old company, this week announced that it was adding some colors to its Band-Aids. I, like many of us, thought that already existed. Mm. And they offered a literal Band-Aid in response to what is happening here and around the world. But I would suggest it's time to rip that Band-Aid off. It's time to tell the truth. It's time to correct the narrative. And that is the only way, in my opinion, that we can move forward and begin some real conversations, real reconciliation, real healing.
Earl, I want to thank you for calling in. And I want to direct everyone to Earl's organization. It's a national effort to take down monuments to the Confederacy coast to coast. Go to takeitdown.org. Earl Johnson Jr. on the line. Thank you, Earl.
Thank you very much.
And this has been such an important discussion, but I have to make note of another headline from the week before we let you guys go. COVID cases in Florida are spiking again. In fact, the state set a record this week for the most new cases in one day. Out at the beach, several bars have actually had to close right after they reopened, after more than two dozen people reported testing positive for coronavirus after just one night out with their friends. Our partner News for Jax looked at zip codes across the area, and they found the zip code that covers Jax Beach is a real hot spot. Something to be aware of. You know, Mike Mendenhall, other mayors around Florida are mandating the wearing of masks as a response to the uptick in cases. We are not seeing this in Jacksonville. We are being encouraged to, but there's no mandate.
No. And, you know, with I have to wonder, too, with the RNC a couple months away, you know, what would the optics of that be for, you know, a Republican mayor to mandate wearing masks, you know, reinstituting some form of COVID-19, you know, capacity restrictions or making it more strict in the lead up. I think that a lot of these businesses, you know, I mean, some of them even who didn't have COVID-19 cases that they knew about coming through their establishment in Jack's Beach or in that area still closed down temporarily to do deep cleans and just as an abundance of precaution. But, you know, a lot of these businesses do need that guidance from our policymakers and
half the Neptune Beach police force, Nikisha, I believe, is in quarantine right now. This virus is very much still with us.
There's no vaccine. Let's start there.
Right.
There's no vaccine. And the virus is in the air. It's literally in the air. That's why everybody is wearing a mask and a face shield. And if you go into a hospital, the doctors are getting goggles and stuff so that you can't get it into your body. There's no vaccine. It's in the air. I know it's summertime. It's hot. The beach is calling. But you could die. I mean, what's more important?
I mean, what we've learned this week, I'll let David Barreline close this out, is we can't let down our guard. We still have to be mindful of this virus.
Right. I mean, social distancing worked. It curbed the spread of the virus. And then when you lift the social distancing restrictions and people are gathered in places like bars and restaurants and they're close together and they're breathing the same air, then it's going to spread. I mean, that's the reality of it. Now the strategy for that would be test, and identify things early, and then use that information to try and have people quarantine until they're over the virus.
Until they're over the virus. So be mindful, everyone. And I want to thank all four of you, Nikisha Williams, David Barreline, Tim Gibbons, and Mike Mendenhall. It's Juneteenth, by the way, today. More about that after the break. Thank you all so much for being with us, and have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Melissa.
And when we come back, the push to make Juneteenth a national holiday, plus Mosh reopens with some precautions. Back in a moment.
The Terrell Hogan Law Firm. Is your business suffering because of coronavirus? Your insurance policy may already provide coverage. Not sure how to tell? Learn more at terrellhogan.com.
FPL. Storm season is here, and FPL is ready. Customers should prepare for storm season 2, as FPL works to keep all the lights on. More details are available at fpl.com/storm.
One Florida Clinical Research Consortium is looking for essential workers in healthcare to join the HERO Registry and help researchers at the University of Florida and nationwide understand what their experience is like on the front lines of COVID-19. Nurses, food service workers, respiratory therapists, environmental service workers, long-term care facility workers, emergency responders, and other clinical and non-clinical personnel can join online at heroesresearch.org.
Elevators, in normal times, are just a part of getting to work. Now, though,
no one kind of knows what's going on or what they should do, and everyone's kind of paranoid.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Elevators reopening and coronavirus next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT.
The Supreme Court deals the president a stunning rebuke. John Bolton has a book to sell and a score to settle. And Aunt Jemima leads the way as corporate America reckons with racist mascots that now won't appear on the kitchen table. I'm Celeste Headlee. Join me for the Friday News Roundup next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, today, Friday, June 19th, is Juneteenth. And this might be the year Juneteenth gets the attention it has long sought and deserves. Juneteenth marks the day in 1865 when people held as slaves in Texas finally learned that slavery had actually ended 2 years previously when President Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. The proclamation freed all persons held as slaves in the states that had rebelled against the Union, and Texas was one of them. And there's a bit of history as to why it took so long for those folks to find out, but Texas did declare Juneteenth an official state holiday in 1980. 46 states in the District of Columbia have some kind of observance, and that includes observances that will happen here in Florida today. There are calls, renewed calls, in the era we're living through now to make Juneteenth a national holiday. So keep your eye on that. And happy Juneteenth, everybody. Meanwhile, as the community opens up, so are some new exhibits around town. The Museum of Science and History, or MOSH, has a new one. It's called Dinosaurs Around the World. Now, you will see some safety precautions in place at the museum to protect against the coronavirus. Here's Alec Warren, Education Manager at the MOSH. Alec, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So as museums like yours and other institutions open around town, we want to let people know what's happening. Even in this time of COVID, you've got a new summer exhibition at MOSH, Dinosaurs Around the World. What are people going to see?
Yeah, absolutely. We're super excited to have this exhibit. It's been well-traveled. It's been around for about 10 years or so, and we're happy to have it at MOSH. It's got T-Rexes, Triceratops, Velociraptor, a lot of those classic fun dinosaurs, as well as one that you've never seen before on display anywhere else. It's the Spinosaurus, which is over 50 feet long and is a huge, epic dinosaur.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with dino exhibits, can you? It's just endlessly fascinating.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, you're doing this at the MOSH with some protocols in place to protect the public because the coronavirus pandemic is still active. What will people experience when they enter the museum?
Yeah. So, you know, we've been planning for several months for this time for being reopened to the public. Obviously, the pandemic has affected us all in ways large and small, and MOSH certainly hasn't been immune to that. But we're happy to finally have a plan in place that we feel allows us to serve the public in as safe a way as we possibly can. Now, some of the changes that guests will notice when they first come in, they're going to notice it before they even come to the museum. And that's we've gone to a timed ticketing process that's online. So you're going to want to go to our website, www.themosh.org, in order to purchase your tickets. We will have a small number of walk-up tickets available, but really the only way you're going to guarantee your spot in the museum is by going online. And that's just to control the amount of people that are in the building at one time. Some other changes, everyone over the age of 12 is going to be required to wear a mask when they're in the building. If you're under the age of 12, we do recommend that you wear a mask, but it's not going to be required of you. But we are going to be asking all of our guests to wear masks. Now, if you don't have a mask, you can always purchase them for $1. We are selling those on site. So if you forget it or you just don't have it, don't worry. We have those available for you for a very small cost. And we've also made other changes such as hand sanitizer stations throughout the building, designated walkways to help control traffic flow, and just other small things like that, such as additional cleaning procedures internally as well.
So again, it's themosh.org to learn more. And this exhibit is open now. You guys open this week, yes?
That's right, yes. So we opened to the public this past Monday, June 15th. And the exhibit's going to be here through October 4th. So we've got it for a good long while.
So check it out at the Mosh, their new exhibit, Dinosaurs Around the World with Social Distancing and Other Measures to Be Safe. Alec Warren is Education Manager at the Museum of Science and History on Jacksonville South Bank. Again, themosh.org. Alec, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And before we go, one quick note. There is so much going on in the midst of this pandemic and recession that is draining, upsetting, scary. But there's a lot of positive news happening, too, in our community. People doing amazing things to help each other and to better this place we call home. We're going to start highlighting it in a new e-newsletter every Wednesday. It's called What's Good Wednesdays? Fresh, sparkling midweek updates from me and the First Coast Connect team. A free and positive pop every week in your email inbox. You can sign up for What's Good Wednesdays on our homepage at wjct.org. Just look to the right side of the page and sign up for our new e-newsletter. We'll keep you in the loop on what's good on our menu. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, too. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. The station news director at WJCT is Jessica Palumbo, and our digital editor is Bill Bortsfield. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to tune in today at noon for the Florida Roundup as we look at the COVID outbreak rising across the state of Florida this week. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll see you on Monday and connect with you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.